Okay, well, thanks for being here still. And you sure you really want to do this? It's the last talk. Okay. Yes? Okay, good. So I'm going to talk about visual learning, learning of the kind of learnings we do about objects, and I'm going to focus on the visual system. And so I want to emphasize this because Marlene talked about the distributed systems that support our processing or recognition of faces, for example. I'm going to be interested in something that's, different, because I'm talking about the change that occurs when we're learning about objects. And so whether or not this may be distributed or not is an interesting question. And this is work that, the work I'm going to talk about has been done by Jonathan Fulstein and Yetta, who are here. Yetta's here. Where's Jonathan? There he is. Good. And Tom Palmieri, who's here somewhere, too. That good. Some people who aren't here. But then I should also say that, we've been working in Penn for, 8 years at least? I mean, there's nothing, none of my ideas ever are occurring, independently anymore. I mean, there's just so much influence from these wonderful discussions with the people who are here and the people who have gone through Penn over the years. And it's been really wonderful for the last 2 or 3 years to have that environment enriched by in the TDLC. And my hope is that by, talking about this today, I'm going to get some people outside of Penn saying, hey, let's work together. So that's really, that's what this is. People look at objects differently, right? With different amounts of expertise and experience, and sometimes with different goals. Now, I think this can, lead you to pay attention to objects in different ways and sometimes remember them better. So, for example, to give you an example of someone who has no experience with shoes, I don't think that Tom Palmieri would be able to tell you which of these shoes I own. Tom, give us a guess. This one? Okay. Annabeth, what do you say? I have this one. Which one? I have this one for sure. And I wear this all the time, and I see Tom every day. And,
When you wear shoes like this, you always find people will not notice them.
But, Tom has really no experience in this domain. Now this takes us to differences in expertise for different categories. But even if you look in novices, right? Even if you look in the brains of people who claim not to have any specific experience different from everybody else, you have people who are, most of us are experts with faces and then letters and all sorts of domains. And you see, we have a field that has really, describe a lot of category selectivity in the ventral system and elsewhere. And I'm going to today focus on the visual system, but I want to, acknowledge what Marlene is saying. This is not happening in a vacuum, okay? But I want to focus on here. Now, why do we, obviously, I and other people in Penn have been interested in how we get this sort of organization in the ventral system. Some of the projects in my lab address the more moments-to-moments temporal dynamics of learning, especially since I've been working in a TDLC. But here, I really want to kind of step back to ask a very basic, but still, I think, temporal question, which is about experience. Does the way in which we experience objects influence the way in which we see them, and in particular, the way in which our visual system sees them? Okay, And there's debate on this. Despite the sort of data that, for example, Mike just spoke about, stuff that we've done several years ago in my dissertation work with Mike, where we, trained people with Griebels and found changes in the FFA with expertise, this is still debated. So this is an example from a recent TICS paper where these guys are saying that, there were these findings of changes in the FFA in a few studies, but really those studies didn't look much outside of these face selective areas. In fact, when you look everywhere in the visual system, what you seem to find is that visual learning is not supported by focal changes, but more by moderate but distributed changes. And I guess what's interesting here is you want to ask, well, you know, if these changes are very moderate and distributed, could they really be at the basis of the organization of the, you know, the categorical organization in the visual system where you see a lot of hot spots? So maybe it could, maybe it couldn't, you know, but that's an important question. How do you get to have that? You know, maybe it's innate, some of it can't be. I mean, when you get a letter selective area, word form area, that, you know, we don't think of that as innate. So some of it has to be learned, and some of it is pretty focal when you look at it in imaging. Now, this is another example that supports this idea of really very little focal change. In fact, here, very little change at all. This is a study in monkeys training monkeys with one of three different categories of objects that look very different in their shape. This is one monkey, this is another monkey, and this is the map in their visual system before they get any training, okay? And the color map is basically when you see green, it's more response to these spiky objects. When you see blue, it's more response to these other objects, and the blobby objects are red. So this is during a color task where the shape is irrelevant, and you can see that there seems to be a map of shape there, and it's different in the two monkeys. Now, what you see in the second set is what's happening after a lot of training with one category. So monkey J is trained with these objects, the spikies, and monkey M with these blobby objects, and you know, there's a bit of change. But it's hard to claim that these, this is the point made in this paper, the difference between the two monkeys doesn't seem to be so much attributed to the training, because they were pretty different to start with. And then this is yet another task, a shape task now, and you know, the claim through a bunch of analyses is that really the map that you see in IT cortex is more or less independent of the meaning of the objects, the familiarity of the objects, and the behavioral tasks that the monkeys are doing. And that's a pretty strong claim. So I'm gonna tell you about, you know, three examples here where we're investigating. Yeah, some of you, I know, some of you will get, you know, it's like, oh, and you want to rush out and find some chocolate. I apologize. I'm going to tell you about three studies where we're looking into this question of whether learning can change your perception of objects. Now, I'm going to start with an example from category learning, and this is work where I'm doing with Tom Palmieri and Jonathan Folstein, and you know, I wouldn't know much about category learning if it wasn't for my work with Tom. And this work has been in large part supported by TDLC. So there are many ways to categorize objects. And so you may look at this, and some of you may prefer dark or milk chocolates you're attending to that dimension, or the, you know, decorations on these. But you know, let's say you were allergic to peanuts, and I told you that some of these, half of these, have peanuts in them. And I say, well, it's actually, you know, those that are a little smaller. And so, well, you would then be paying attention to size. And you may, with a lot of practice, end up, you know, being better at processing the size of these objects because it's now relevant. So we may create a category that at first was not relevant, right? So categorization could be very important. And in some studies in the field, imaging and neurophysiology studies find no effect of such category learning on visual perception. However, as some people in this room know, you know, other studies do. Other studies have found that when you learn to categorize visual stimuli, it can really change your perception of these stimuli. So I can't preview this whole literature, but Jonathan, together with us, you know, have gone through a lot of you know, kind of asking what could be at the basis of these differences, and I really want to give a lot of credit to Jonathan for coming up with the hypothesis, because it wasn't obvious at all in the literature. But here's one possibility, which is that these studies that look at category learning are done in morph spaces that are actually can be made in two different ways, and this is not at all obvious in the literature. So in this top example, what you have is a space And the green area is what the subjects would see. These are the stimuli that subjects would see and learn to categorize according to this boundary here. But these are made from taking two parents, so parents A and parent B, and creating a dimension, and then another dimension from two other parents, and then systematically combining those so that you have what we call a dimensional space. Okay, and what's important in this space is that if you move along in this direction, in the vertical direction in this space, the similarity of the objects to parent A and parent B is not changing. You're just changing according to the one dimension. In contrast, some of the studies are done with a space like this. Now, the stimuli that the subjects see are just these central images, and there's a category boundary. But what you have here is what we call a polar space, where every stimulus in here is a combination of the four parents. And so what this means is that when you move through the space, the similarity of the objects is changing relative to all four parents. Okay, so what we decided to do, because the studies using these different spaces were used different sorts of images and were different in many ways, we wanted to compare what the effect of using these two spaces were. So this is what this looks like if you put them both into the same 3D space. So a dimensional space is is a plane, right? And you can, again, you can selectively attend to one dimension. And the spaces, this is a space like the one that Rob Goldstone has used in his studies and found an effect of category learning on perception. And this space, as you see, is more of a warped plane where, when you move through the space, a lot is changing at the same time. So we use the same stimuli, but we train people to categorize them according to a boundary in the same way, but one group used a polar space and the other group used a dimensional space. And then we were interested in how well they could discriminate pairs of objects. So we had them discriminate a bunch of pairs. Some of them were pairs that differed along the diagnostic dimension, the dimension that's relevant for categorization. And then some of them were along the other dimension, right? So here are the results that we found. So the question is whether visual discrimination, so this is D prime here, is affected by category learning, and it depends on the space. So what we're showing here, it's in the dimensional space, is that from pre to post training, for pairs that vary along the diagnostic dimension, you see an increase in sensitivity. Okay? You don't see this a lot for the non-diagnostic dimension. Okay. So this is very similar to what Rob had found with more simple stimuli and also with faces, and we replicated with cars. But with the same cars, you cannot find this effect in a polar space. Okay? So whether you can find the effect or not depends on the space. Okay? So just to summarize here, one view that's supported by fMRI neurophysiology is that category learning does not depend on changes in the visual system. And that's because in those studies, most of the action predicts category membership is really supported by the frontal lobe, and they don't see changes in the visual system. But what we're pointing out here is that those studies use polar spaces, and behaviorally, they don't really find evidence of the sort of changes that you can find in a dimensional space. So in ongoing work, that's partly supported by the TDLC. You also always have to say partly when you're doing something like imaging, because this is expensive work, but would not be done without TDLC. We're looking at fMRI of category learning in dimensional spaces where we think now we can get effects in the visual system. So that's something that you should hear about in the future. What I'm going to talk about now is the overview of another project that asks if different kinds of expertise can result in different kinds of visual representation. So the theme is similar. We're interested in how learning can change visual representations. So when we designed that study, and this is Alan Wong's dissertation work, we looked at the literature and we realized that even though people will say, well, it's all shape and experience is not that important, when you look at studies, there are a lot of studies out there that manipulate shape or category and find that that is an important factor in determining activity in the visual system. A lot of studies manipulating task or attention. A lot of studies manipulating the effect of one training protocol. So, we kind of started this in my dissertation work, but this is not a manipulation of training. It's really just doing one training and showing it has an effect, which is very different from comparing two trainings, right? Because you don't know what in the original Griebel study caused the changes that we saw. You know, it could have been exposure to the objects, for all we knew. We don't know. And very few that compare one training to even just mere exposure. As I said, there's always that possibility that it's just showing the objects that has the effect. So what we wanted to do was manipulate experience, keeping shape and everything else constant, but manipulate experience. So in this study, we used objects that we call the Ziggurats. Those are composed of six classes of objects, and then they're organized such that each column here has objects of different classes, but that are, have a common style, if you want, like a common font, if they were letters. We train people to become experts with these in two different ways. So in one training that I will call here face-like or individuation, because you've heard from several people now that individuation is very important for face processing. So we had people, this is for one subject, but for every subject it would be a subset of each category. So three objects in each category would receive a name, an individual name that you have to learn, remember, and be very good at, very fast at identifying them. But you would see all the objects and get exposed to all of them and learn to individuate some of them, the way we, get to individuate some people and then see a lot of other people. In the other group, in what we are going to call the letter-like training, first of all, subjects only learn six labels for the objects. So this is, this is a very easy comparison because you only distinguish the different classes. And so this is not unlike seeing a lot of letters in different fonts, but learning to call all of these A's and B's and C's, right? So that by itself would be a lot easier than the letter than the individuation training. But I'll show you what the tasks were. And in fact, we went through a lot of trouble to make sure that this training was also very difficult. So in the face-like training, this is very much like we have trained Griebel experts in the past. We show these objects in a few tasks, very simple, where the goal is to get very fluent at individuating them and associating labels. So you might see an object and you have to press the first letter of its name. You might see a name and an object and have to verify that it's the right one. You might see a name and two objects and choose which one applies to the name. So you're just learning these associations of names with objects. Now in the letter-like training, some of the tasks are similar. So you have to name the subjects, but you're naming it at the category level. So only one of six classes, that's a lot easier. Or you verify, it's labeled, but it's a category label. But most of the time in the letter-like training was spent on this task. So in this task, which is meant to model some of the simple visual processing that occurs when you read, taking out a lot of the other more important linguistic processing that, this is very simplifying it to a lot to the bone, I would say. But you would get a matrix of objects, and there wouldn't be any of the pink stuff. This is just for me to show you the task. So you start here at the top. This is your target. And you have to scan the array to find this target. So you scan it, and you find your target, and then you switch. So this now is your new target. And you keep doing that, switching every time you find your target, until you hit the end of the matrix. You press the space bar to say you're done, and then you type the name of the last guy that you were looking for, right? And there could be a variable number of switches. Okay? So the point here is that you're scanning through this as fast as you can. You're only categorizing the objects by class, so that's fairly easy. And also, all of the objects that are shown here are in the same font, the same style. Okay, so they're all from the same column in that matrix, which is just like when you're reading, you all read in the same font. Your task has nothing to do with font, but you get the advantage of this regularity. So the point here is that these are two very different types of training, but the same amount of experience with the same number of objects should lead to different types of learning in the brain. Okay. or not, depending on what your theory is, right? Now, we did a lot of behavioral testing, and I won't go through all of that. I'll just show you one task because it's an important one in phase processing, and that's a task where we measure holistic processing. So we call this the composite task, and this is a trial where you first see a composite of the top and the bottom of two objects. So you look at that, you encode that, then you get a mask and then a cue. The cue tells you that you're going to have to make a judgment here about the top. Then you get another composite image. And your job is to say whether the top, in this case, of the second image is the same as the first image that you encoded. You're supposed to ignore the bottom part completely. Okay? Of course, we're interested in the extent to which you can ignore the bottom part. And if you can't, we're going to call, in phase processing, it's called holistic processing. We also do the same task where in the second image, the parts are misaligned, and this, in phase processing, releases holistic perception or holistic organization. So we're really interested in something that occurs here, but not in the other case. And this is response time on this task for three groups, the face-like group, the letter-like group, and this is a control group doing this task on the Ziegerans. They've never seen them before. And we have trials that are congruent, where the top and bottom parts would really give you the same answer, and trials that are incongruent, where the part that you're supposed to ignore could interfere with your response. And so the prediction here is that if you can do what we're asking you to do, which is attend to part of the object, you should not see a congruency effect. And so this is what you see in the control group. These subjects who are just processing the Ziegerans for the first time, they're a little slower than people who've seen a lot of them. They can do the task. They're pretty accurate. But they show no congruency effect. And the letter-like group people don't either, right? They're fast. They've done a lot of work with Ziegerans. They're very fast, but they don't show what the marker of holistic processing. But the face-like group, people who have learned to individuate the Ziegerans, then are showing holistic processing for aligned Ziegerans and not for misaligned Ziegerans. So this was an indication, one of a few, that our two trainings were creating different perceptual strategies. Now, we scan people before and after these trainings, this is the typical experimental run we did. So we have a control blocks where people see objects in different categories, and they're just monitoring one-back repetitions of these objects. But what we're interested in are the Ziegerin blocks, and so the task here is always one back. So you see these objects one at a time, and if you see one that repeats, you just, this is a repetition. But in some blocks, we're showing you objects that are all within the same class, and in other blocks, we're showing you objects that are between class. Okay, so we do this both before and after our training. This here is the result of an ROI analysis in the right FFA and the left letter selective area. These are group-defined regions of interest defined functionally. So this is the region that responds the most to faces in this group. What we're plotting here is the change. So this is the difference for Ziegerans minus objects post minus what you get at pretest. So anything positive here is an increase in activity for Ziegerans over other objects. And what you can see in all of this is just one area of change, which is that only for the face-like training group, the people trained to individuate Ziegerin in the right FFA, do we see an increase. And we see it only in this task where they have to look for repetitions among distractors that are within the same class. So that's a very focal change that we don't see elsewhere. And in fact, I should say we can show a nice correlation between the magnitude of the holistic processing in individual subjects and the activity in the fusiform gyrus of these subjects. So it really does seem to be tied to how much of a change in holistic processing occurs, predicts how much activity you get for Ziegerin. This is a strong correlation. So this actually replicates something that we'd found before with Griebel's. But what's interesting is to look for, you know, in these regions of interest analysis, we didn't find anything for the letter-like training. So is something changing? They're getting better, right? This is a different analysis, which places regions of interest all along the ventral occipital cortex. And so when you're in the middle here, you're in these medial areas, and then you go more lateral, right? This is really what this is, going for more interior in the temporal lobe and going posterior. And again, we're plotting change. So if you see something that's close to zero, it's not because there's no activation, right? As Marlene said, there's activation in a lot of areas, but we're seeing no change from pre to post. But what you can see, first of all, in the face-like training group, the blue, is very little change if you look at these maps of distributed activity. But if you look at the letter-like training group, you see very significant change, but it is very distributed. It's not in one spot. What you're seeing is this kind of change like this, where you get relatively more activity in medial areas and relatively less activity in lateral areas. So this is a very distributed pattern of change, not something that you see in one little spot. It's really happening all over the visual cortex and is the main marker of change that we've seen in the brain in the letter-like training. So, and this is happening somewhat more strongly here in the between class blocks, which is the block that really should tap into the kind of learning that the letter-like group did. Okay, so how you experience objects, because these are very different trainings, seems to matter to your visual system. You know, you learn the same objects, they have the same geometry, get the same amount of exposure to them, and yet the changes are not the same. So learning the same objects can translate into either local changes or distributed changes, depending on the training task. So the last example I want to give you here is work by Yetta and Jonathan, comparing expertise at, again, individuating objects to another kind of learning, which is typically called perceptual learning and has been also the focus of some imaging study, but it's quite different from the kind of learning that we've studied in our work, so we wanted to compare them. So this is an example of, this is an fMRI study that we modeled our perceptual learning task after. It's a task where each subject gets a target. So for example, one subject might learn to detect inverted T's fixating on an array on the screen, and this array of stimuli are going to show up and be shown very briefly, and you have and the target, the stimuli are at about 3.5 degrees, and you're supposed to say present, absent. You know, is my target in this array or not? And you practice this until you're really, really good. The learning is specific to the target orientation. Okay, so if you look at the, after a lot of training, people are really good at detecting this orientation but not detecting the other orientation. So this is a map of the activity after a lot of training for detecting the target in the train orientation compared to the untrained orientation. So what you're seeing is, first of all, there was only one focus of activity in early visual cortex. You know, it could be V1, but if it's not, it's close to V1. And then you also got a lot of relative decrease in activation in a bunch of frontal, parietal, and even some ventral areas that we can't quite see here. So a massive decrease all over the brain, and then a small focal increase in this task, which is very different from what I've shown you in individuation of expertise. So we were really interested in, how you bridge these two. So we decided to bridge perceptual expertise and perceptual learning. So perceptual learning, the task I've just shown you, the Sigmund task, uses a simple and unique target for the whole training, and peripheral presentation. And it's an orientation discrimination task. You're really, saying, is the T in the right orientation? Yes or no? And you're finding your target. In perceptual expertise, we have complex objects and multiple objects, and we typically have always trained them with central presentation, and the task is individuation. So, not surprising you find differences, except that it's impossible to attribute them to anything because it could be anything. So how do you go about this? Well, we decided to start here by creating two trainings that brought these two things, closer together. So we're going to have a perceptual learning task with complex, multiple targets, peripheral presentation, and an orientation discrimination task. we're going to have a perceptual expertise task with complex multiple targets, peripheral presentation, and an individuation task. So the only difference is really going to be the task that you're going to perform on the objects. Okay? So these are the objects, and you should maybe recognize them because they're the Ziggurats, but silhouettes. We figured if you were going to present these things very briefly in the periphery, we wouldn't go into very subtle little details of the shading, and so we went for silhouettes. But nonetheless, these objects here that you're going to have to individuate in this training, so you're going to have to, individuate all of the trained objects here in this training when they're presented very briefly at 3.5 degrees. This is very hard. And then we're going to test people also with novel exemplars of this category. So they've never seen these before, but we're interested in how well they can transfer. And then we also have objects from a novel category that they've never seen before. So the training tasks are simple. The visual search task is just like the Sigmund task that you've seen. So on any trial, you get an array, and your task, you have one target orientation that's been assigned to you, and we counterbalance all of this, so you just have to say, is your target present or not? But all these shapes are the same in one display. Now, in the next display, they could be different, and so you're going to see all these shapes, you're going to see them. The identity is irrelevant. You're just detecting whether you see your target, which I'm not sure which one it is now. I'm sure Yetta knows, but let's say it could be this one. So you say present. Some are absent. In the individuation training, you're going to fixate here, but you're going to see an object in the periphery, and you're supposed to type the first letter of its name. You don't know where it's going to show up, and it shows up for 300 milliseconds? 150 milliseconds. So it's quick. They're at 3.5 degrees, as I said. So you do this for a long, long time. I'm not going to show you that they learn, but they do learn. But it's a hard task. And they practice this for 8 hours. Thank you. Now we get behavioral changes, and they're different for the two groups. So here I'm showing you the inversion effect this visual search task. So this is just like the training task, right? And you can see at pretest there's no inversion effect. There's no reason to get an advantage for one orientation over the next. But after training, so these are the trained exemplars, the group who's been practicing this task certainly does a lot better on the upright and inverted orientation. And they can generalize this to objects they've never seen, but from the category. But if you go to another category they've never seen, obviously there's no transfer of that. You wouldn't expect them. You don't see any of this for the subjects in the individuation training test. Now, and again, I'm not showing you all the tests that we did, but I want to show you one that's interesting because here both groups change. So this is a test. This is a shape matching task. And in noise, because if you're going to show these images centrally, then everything becomes a lot easier. And so we got a noise threshold of how much noise could we put there for 85% accuracy, I think. So the task is simple. You get one Ziggurat, and then you get two, and you have to decide whether the left or the right one matches. And we look at the how much noise we can put in here. And you're seeing the performance of the two groups. And what you see is an improvement, but for both groups, which I think is interesting. So from pretest to post-test, there's an improvement for the trained exemplars. But even for people who were paying attention, were doing the visual search task, never really paying attention to the identity of these objects, and they still got better at this. Okay. So this is a summary of the behavioral changes that we see. So we see differences. We see upright specific but category general improvement in orientation detection. This is something that we see only in the perceptual learning training. But we also see category general improvement in shape matching, and we actually see this depending on both trainings. And so it's important to realize some of the changes that we see when we train people to expertise may not depend on the task so much, and others do. Right. So this is not a general statement about everything is task specific. It depends, but really you need to do the work to figure it out. Now, quickly, I'm going to show you some fMRI results from this study. So in the scanner, we do two different things. We do the visual search task. I mean, Remember, perceptual learning is supposed to be very specific, not only to the objects that you've trained people with, but to the tasks that they do. So we have to go in the scanner and test them in the tasks that we train them. Otherwise, we wouldn't expect any change. So we do that. And we also do a matching task where on every trial you see two objects and you have to decide if they're the same or not. And we do this with upright and inverted. No, upright is just the orientation that every subject is trained with. And then inverted objects, and then also a control of a novel object category that we don't expect to see any changes. So the first thing I'm showing you here is this is flattened cortex, the left and the right hemisphere. This is a group map. And this is activity in the visual search task, but this is an interaction map, the session by orientation interaction. What this means is that the red areas here are the areas where the inversion effect for trained object is increasing, okay, from pre-test to post-test. So this is an increase in the inversion effect, and in blue it would mean the inversion effect is decreasing. Okay? And I put some markers. We also look at functional regions of interest, so I'm telling you what these areas are doing. And these are those green areas here are regions of interest, because you're going to see a few of these maps. Now, what you can see here is very different from what Sigmund saw in this test. You know, remember, he found an increase in early visual cortex and then a massive decrease everywhere. And that's not what we see. We see mostly an increase in a lot of areas of the brain, including visual area, ventral areas, more parietal areas, and a few areas of decrease, but those are fairly focal. So even though the task is the same as Sigmund, the stimuli are very different, and that may be critical in the pattern of change that we're seeing. So this is the visual search group. This is the individuation group, okay? But in this task, in the visual search task, so from pre to post, what's changing here is actually a few areas, ventral and dorsal, are decreasing. So they're showing less activity for the train orientation than the inverted orientation. So again, a very big difference that can only be explained by the training. Okay? Here I'm showing you a different interaction map. This is during the shape matching task, right? So this is a task that you would think would tap into the sort of perceptual expertise that we've used before. And again, here red would be areas that would show more activity for the trained category compared to the untrained category. So an increase for the trained category after training. And what you're seeing for the visual search group is not a whole lot, some areas of increase up here, but a decrease in the right PPA, and I want you to compare this with what you see in the individuation group. Like, notice you're not seeing these very massive changes everywhere, but in the individuation group, you're seeing increases in ventral cortex, which we're not seeing up there. So differences that seem to depend on the training task. So. This is just summarizes the maps that I've shown you. The point I want to make here is that you might ask whether the changes that you see depend on the task that you do at test, right? So whether you're doing a visual search task or a shape matching task, but that's not what we see. And you might say, well, maybe it's all going to depend on the training that you've done, but that's not what we see. We really see an interaction here where the changes that you see that are due to learning depend on both how you were trained, so the task that you got good at during training, and how you're tested. Okay, so there's an interaction here that's very salient. So I think I'm almost done. Our experience with objects influences the way we and our visual system see them. It seems too simplistic to say that all visual learning is supported by modest distributed changes in IT. It seems that something that emerges from these studies and other work in our lab is that individuation in particular seems to lead to fairly focal changes. Now, I want to clarify, I'm not saying that Marlene wasn't right. I think there's a large, widely distributed network that's involved in the processing. I'm talking about the change. When you're learning to individuate these objects, what do you see here in imaging in terms of a change? And that's very focal for individuation, whereas for some of the other tasks, it is a lot more distributed. Okay. Now, there are further questions that you might want to think about. So do temporal aspects of the training, we're looking right now at a number of different aspects of the training that may be important. But we may be interested in exploring temporal aspects of the training, so the order in which you see the objects that are learned, the spacing between stimuli and session. If you only change those parameters, is it going to change the visual representation? And we don't know that. It's never been done, really. Are the neural mechanisms of these more distributed or local changes the same, or are they supported by different mechanisms? And that's something that is intriguing to me. And what are the finer temporal dynamics of these changes? Of course, you have to believe that these changes occur before you look at this question. So, as I said, there's debate. So working at this level now, but ultimately I think we are interested in describing the change. So again, this is the work of people in this room and outside of this room, and it's funded by TDLC and others. So thank you. Yes, Susie.
Hello.
Okay.
Hello.
So it occurs to me that the two different types of training that you have separated out, the face-like and the letter-like, were essentially combined in the original Griebel training studies, right? Because people learned how to categorize at the gender or family level, but they learned to individuate some subset of the Griebels as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, most of, the letter-like training may seem just like a basic level training, but it's not. I think if it was, we wouldn't find much that's interesting. And, I think most of the changes that we're seeing in the letter-like training have to do with the matrix scanning test that they spend most of their time doing.
Okay, so maybe I'll ask you to do a thought experiment. If you had doubled the training and had people learn both the letter categories as well as a subset of the individual items, do you imagine that the changes that you would see with learning would just be muddled, or do you think that there would be some kind of
That's a really
additive effect? Or
I mean, we right now, we've been focusing on showing divergence of trainings for the same objects, and the next step really is, what if you acquire two different kinds of expertise with the same objects? Are you going to see, in this case, local changes in the FFA or around the FFA and this more, global change where you get more activity medially? It could be. You could get both. They're not, mutually exclusive. I think there are other types of trainings where you could set up that are more opposite, where it'd be really interesting to ask these questions too. So there's a lot of work to do there. But keep in mind, there's very little work. I mean, in imaging, there's some in Penn, Tim and Jim and some other people in Penn have done similar work in ERPs comparing training paradigms. But there's just not a lot of this in imaging, so, yeah.
I'm going to ask a question that's stimulated by your talk, but it goes to the whole room.
Sure.
And it's a privilege to be able to ask this room, because probably if there is an answer, somebody here knows it. Maybe you'd be the most likely. I've been looking over the years at many, many studies from Mrzenich's lab and many, many other places in which people have shown all kinds of changes. And the changes one sees in the brain as a result of training studies are really diverse. And, sometimes you see, for example, differentiation of maps. Other times you see all the neurons recruited to respond to the same stimulus. And my graduate students and I haven't been able to figure out why you see one change or another. And one of the things we've wanted is an experiment in which you have a dissociation between task and stimulus, just the ensemble of stimuli that you've actually seen, right? So I was stimulated to ask this question specifically by the, Goldstone style experiment, which you have almost here, right? Where you have the two-dimensional morph and you can draw a boundary through that in either of two ways. You can show exactly the same set of stimuli, mm-hmm. and you can get, you can make subjects do different tasks with those, and then, has anybody ever done?
You're doing it. So okay. This is Annabeth here. Raise your hand. She's setting up that study now, and I think it's an important study because there's some work in, I've cited here, category learning in the visual system, but I'm really bothered by the fact that I mean, there's, you know, category learning, theoretically, the way it's done in a lot of, and that's okay, it's like arbitrary category learning. I think to the visual system, you may need more than that to push it, which is that in the real world, when you learn categories, especially for things that are very visually similar, you do it for a good reason, which is that you're going to have to do different things with these objects, right? Mm-hmm. And so we want to create an arbitrary category boundary and then train people. It's kind of like the Ziegerin study, but within subject in the same space, you know, train people to do two very different things on two parts of the space. And I think then the boundary becomes very meaningful to the visual system because it predicts the visual task, the perceptual strategy that you're supposed to use. So I'm guessing that we're going to get even more changes in the visual system when we get into something like that.
So you're going to teach them tasks and see how...
Yeah, in different parts
yeah,
of the...
Yeah, I want yeah, you to teach and, different and, individuals
right, and the goal is that you can
then,
show an object and their goal is to do the task they're supposed to do. So they, in order to do this, they have to do category membership, but this is not explicit. They just have to... You know, say, oh, it's an A, and so I do this task, yeah. But if it's a B,
so that's an experiment. That's not exactly the experiment I'm looking for, but it's a good one. But I want you to teach half the subjects one category and the other half this split and this split.
Jonathan's doing that.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it's. I mean, he's almost done. And what
have we learned about this?
Well, you know, it's been done. The study has been done, but it's been done, as I said, in a polar space, where what they found then, both in physiology and fMRI, was mostly changes in the frontal lobe. Now, there are subtleties here, because they weren't looking so much at for diagnostic effect, like the way that Rob has. They were looking for categorical perception. But, you know, it's similar, and they were finding no effects of categorical perception in the visual system, all the effects in the frontal lobe. And behaviorally, you know, very little evidence of the kinds of changes that Rob has seen. And so our claim here, what we're hypothesizing, is that if you do this in a dimensional space where you can selectively attend to a dimension behaviorally, mm-hmm. then you might be able to see the changes in the visual system. So, and we're not done running.
You're not done. Okay.
So
well, at least you're doing it.
Yeah, so you're
okay.
trying to
add I'll come back next year and find
we're
out.
We're going to be able to tell you about this.
So this is... A question about your experiments, and was it the case that the objects always had the same size during training and testing?
On
the retina.
In these studies, they do. Although we don't fix. We don't use a chin rest in those studies, and so there's going to be, a bit except for the perceptual learning, right? The visual search task where in the Ziegerin study. With the silhouettes, that's fixed. But the other ones, it varies just randomly. But we didn't vary that.
Well, invariance with size is a big deal in computer vision. I was wondering how much generalization in these experiments would you expect if you tested with a different size?
A lot. I would expect a lot of generalization. Behaviorally, I think we have some evidence of that before. I think if you set up a really sensitive experiment in the brain, you could see sensitivity to that, given where the field has gone. So, but I don't think it's critical. You know, I don't think that these expertise effects are that specific to a size. But it's we don't have a whole lot of data to speak about. So. Okay, well, we're done. Well, thank you.